Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I am absolutely thrilled to be here and to share with you some of my current thinking, what gets me up in the morning. And as I was thinking about this talk, I was reminded of the words, one of my favorite lines recently, the founder of Visa, in his book, The Dawn of the Chaotic Age, he said, "It is far too late, and things are far too bad for pessimism." I think a lot of us are feeling that way right now, and it sort of speaks to me. But as I, the official title for this talk, Living Democracy, A Feeding Hope, I began to think that maybe I should have called it The Work of Hope. Because I'm convinced more and more that hope is not a matter of disposition or, you know, some good fortune. It is work. It is a project. And I've become more and more convinced of its centrality in life. And what I mean by that is that maybe the work of hope is the most important work. Because as we face these absolutely unprecedented crises, and I'm willing to take a risk of, I know every generation thinks it's unprecedented, but I think we're different. I think we are. I mean, how many generations in history have actually been alive for at least three seismic rifts in the social order? I mean, when we think about it, whether it's global climate change or the humanitarian crisis of a deepening hunger, or you name it now, the meltdown of our global economy. I mean, here we are. So I am willing to say that in such a time that there is only one thing that we really have to worry about. And it's not any of these particular crises. The only thing we have to really worry about is the threat of despair. And despair comes, I believe, from my experience, and I just turned 65, and, you know, my experience now has a great new meaning for me, because I feel like, you know, when you're 65, that means when you say, my lifetime, I've seen, you know, it really counts for something. So I love it. So what I feel that I've observed in myself over these decades and seen in others is that really, hopelessness, despair, which I'm claiming is our only real threat, comes from a sense of futility. Excuse me. Sense of futility that we, and why do we feel that way? Because we cannot see how our individual acts connect to the causal pattern that is taking us down, down, down. If we see how our individual acts actually can break and reverse that pattern, then the energy, the drive, we're willing to take whatever time it takes, whatever generations it takes, if we can just see that connectedness between our choices and the causal patterns that are taking us down. So that's where I am. And so a metaphor that I found very useful, my daughter and I hit upon when we were doing our book tour for Hope's Edge. We were in Seattle on a rainy night. And we were thinking about this sense of futility that people have when they say, oh, I'm just a drop in the bucket, as if that's nothing. But that night in Seattle, we thought, you know, filling drops fill up those buckets pretty fast. So being a drop in the bucket is actually a magnificent thing if you can see the bucket. So our real challenge here, you know, shifting metaphors all over the place, but I hope you'll bear with me. The real challenge here is seeing the bucket, seeing what it is in a positive way that our actions are filling up. And that's really, so somewhere between these various metaphors I've thrown out is what I want to be talking about tonight. Is that how do we begin to understand the causal patterns that have gotten us here so that we can then see what it takes in our individual acts to shift that pattern toward life. And so that sense of cause and effect is key. So I started, as David said, many decades ago with the question, because it seemed like the most basic question of all, why hunger? I was in my mid-20s, and hunger was hitting the international marquee. Suddenly people were realizing that world hunger was a reality. And so I thought, if I could just figure out why people are hungry in the world, then that would begin to unlock the mysteries of economics and politics. Because what is more basic? Every species does it, feeds itself and its offspring, and we, the brainiest species, hadn't figured that one out yet. So I buried myself in the UC Berkeley Ag Library and said, okay, I'm going to understand this. And very soon, I think because I wasn't a trained development expert or nutritionist, I could just sort of put two and two together, you know, beginner's eyes, and can be very useful. And I learned that, in fact, there was more than enough food in the world to make us all chubby. There was then, there still is, even on the leftovers. Now, what I mean by even on the leftovers is after we feed over a third of the world's grain to livestock, after we now feed over a third of the fish catch goes into then feed stock, and of course now we're feeding corn to cars, in effect. So even with that, we are still producing enough food for everyone. In fact, in the last 20 years, well, you know, this myth of scarcity is still with us. It's very tenacious. In fact, we've increased per capita agricultural production about 20% since 1980. So that was the beginning for me when I realized that, oh, my God, we are actually creating the scarcity we say we fear. So I then tried to ask the next question, why would we do that? Why would we be creating the very scarcity, especially scarcity of food, which, of course, every living creature is its greatest terror? Why would we be doing that? And over the years, I have been grateful to learn from many, many, many teachers. And one in particular, the light bulb went on. And many of you of my generation will remember the name Eric Fromm. He wrote a book that was less known but very powerful that I read about 10 years ago called The Anatomy of Human Destructiveness. And there he explains what, of course, is more and more written about now, that human beings are creatures of the mind, that we there is no unfiltered reality for human beings. We create the world according to frames through which we see. What my daughter and I call in our book, Hope Sedge, we call them our mental map. And literally, we can't see what's not on our map. So Fromm writes in this book, he writes, it is man's humanity that makes him so inhuman. And what he's getting at is this unique quality that our capacity to create these mental frames that determine what we can see, what we cannot see, and what we believe human nature to be, they are more powerful than instinct. And if you want to challenge me on that in the Q&A, please do. But let me just say that I think when we reflect on it, we'll see that our frames are more powerful than instinct or can be. So here is then the question. So that's all well and good. If we live in an era in which the dominant mental map is life-serving, but I've come to believe that the dominant map going global today is fundamentally life-denying. And I'll just say very briefly what I mean by that. That it starts, it leads to despair, which is, as I argue, our greatest threat, because I do believe that solutions to our biggest problems are known. It's only our despair of our sense of our powerlessness to manifest solutions that is the real problem. So the premise that dominates the global mental map, at least it is now going global, I argue is the premise of lack. And it begins with the sense of scarcity that then spirals out to a feeling of individual powerlessness, which leads to this sense of futility, which is then the basis of despair, which is our greatest threat. This premise of scarcity, I call it the premise of lack of goods and goodness. There's not enough stuff in the world. We've been told there's not enough food, there's not enough land, there's not enough energy, there's not enough parking places, there's not enough love, there's not enough anything. There's not enough stuff, and there's not enough goodness. There's not enough goods, not enough goodness, because if you just peel away the fluff from human nature, we're told that the only thing you can really count on is that we're selfish, materialistic, and competitive. So if you believe that about us, then what follows is that, of course, you believe that we can't come together and deliberate and dialogue and create societies that work for all of us. We will come to believe that, of course, we have to turn over our fate to some expert. Our best, we turn over our fate to an infallible automatic force so that we flawed human beings don't muck it up. And in my adult life, many believe they have found it. Certainly Ronald Reagan's phrase, the magic of the market, kind of captures it. This idea that there's a magical, sort of mystical solution that if we just, that works on its own, that as long as we don't tamper, it will just bring about the outcomes that we all want. So what I'm saying, if we start with the premise of lack of goods and goodness, then believing that we have to turn over our fate to others and to an infallible automatic law, the magic of the market, the problem is that I'm kind of painting the spiral of powerlessness. The problem with that, one of the problems with that, of course, is that this market that we think of as running automatically is not any kind of market, because markets have served humanity for all of our for our social evolution. But we've hit on this peculiar notion that the market can work for everyone's benefit, driven by a single rule. Highest return to those who already have the wealth, highest return to existing wealth, and it's going to result in benign outcomes for everyone. Well, what happens, of course, is that wealth returns to wealth returns to wealth until we reach a point in our country today, which is directly related to the current meltdown, that one family controls as much wealth as 40% of the population in America. And that is the Waltons, you probably guessed. We reached the point in the world where billionaires are increasing 8 times faster than the global economy. So what I finally kind of dawned on me is that this is something we should have figured out playing Monopoly as kids. I was flashing back to those nights when my brother would finally win, and I would be so relieved because I could finally go to bed, and it kind of worked as a game, but it doesn't work in life. Because the equivalent in life is people die. So, but we set it up like this giant Monopoly game. And I just learned as I was writing Getting a Grip that actually Monopoly was invented by a Quaker woman to teach us an object lesson. It's just so ironic. Her name was Lizzie Maggie. And she drew this board game on some kind of oil cloth. This was the early part of the 20th century. And it was called Landlord, I think. And the idea that we would play this game and we'd catch on, that we shouldn't organize our society this way. Well, the story goes on, as I understand it, that this game idea got into the hands of Parker Brothers. And it sort of proved her point, because Parker Brothers made tons of money on it. And now it's a monopoly. And I think there are 5 companies that produce most of the board games in America, and we didn't learn the lesson. But maybe Lizzie lives today as we see the meltdown of what happens in this giant monopoly game that implodes because it so concentrates wealth. That wealth then, and here's the other part of the spiral of powerlessness, that wealth then infuses our political system so greatly that it is so distorted that, as we've just seen now in the build-up to this meltdown, that the kinds of obvious guidelines and safeguards were pulled away because of the power of concentrated wealth within our political system. To the point that we reach, a friend of mine came up with a term that I just am starting to use all the time now. I wish I could take credit, but I will not. She said, what we've turned into is privately held government. And I think that's a better term for it, privately held government than thin democracy. I think thin democracy is a bit too tame. But in this point, we have been warned by many, many great leaders over time, and that we were heading exactly to where we are today. And some of them have put it so brilliantly, but no one better, I think, no one more eloquently than Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In 1938, he addressed a joint session of Congress, and he said, quote, "The liberty of democracy is not safe if we tolerate the growth of private power to the point that it is stronger than the democratic state itself. That, in its essence, is fascism." Now, I have not found the courage to use the F word without quoting an American president, but I'm working on my backbone. But I think it's a great quote to memorize. If an American president can say it, can name it so clearly. So the picture I'm trying to paint, I began with the only real challenge for us is to have a honest, realistic hope based on evidence based on evidence of how we got here, this spiral I'm beginning to describe, this pattern of causation that takes us into where we are, so that then we can begin to see how we can interrupt the spiral of powerlessness and begin to create a spiral of empowerment. So what I've suggested then, if we start from the premise of lack of goods and goodness, turning over our fate to this infallible force that concentrates and concentrates wealth and then infects and distorts our political decision-making so that we don't have the safeguards as we're seeing today within our financial system, that we end up in where we are today. So I'm suggesting that we have to go at least that deep to begin to ask ourselves in this what I call a moment of dissidence, what will we do? In other words, I'm saying that the dominant frame has told us that if we just accept this very simplistic view of our nature as simply these selfish little shoppers, I like to think of it, and we just do our selfish little shopping and maybe vote, but that's not required. Only shopping is really essential. That things will work out. And now we're seeing that they're not working out. Our explanatory frame is not serving us. And so, of course, you know, people have a choice when their world cracks open. You know, when Alan Greenspan was on the news with those thick glasses saying, I think there was a flaw in how I was perceiving things. I could almost see his lenses cracking, you know. So what do we do when our worldview begins to shatter? Do we try to stick it back together, or do we dig to the roots? And actually, my new metaphor it just hit me the other day, that when we don't have to dig anymore, when the storm hits as it's hitting the world today, you know, you think of what happens to a big tree. The roots kind of pop up. And so I think we're in that point where this storm has felled the tree and we can see roots that we could not see before. And I think that more and more people are eager to at least go this deep, to look at what are the underlying assumptions that have gotten us here and what are very different set of assumptions. And so I would like to suggest, and then I'm going to give some examples of what happens if we move to a very different frame. And the examples I want to give tonight are examples not in the U.S., but in the most desperately poor areas of our world. Because I think if we can see a new frame emerging in situations that are much more dire than ours, that I too think can build this sense of what I think of as honest hope, grounded, not faith-based, but evidence-based. So let me just say that what I see is a very different frame emerging based on a very different premise. Not a premise of lack, but a premise of possibility. And it takes human beings in our complexity. Instead of just focusing on this sliver of humanity that we are, we can be very selfish and competitive and materialistic. And, yes, we acknowledge that. And there is our everyday experience, and now a lot of neuroscience. I love the new neuroscience showing our profoundly and innately pro-social qualities as well. So a different premise, creating a very different sense of causation, is to look at our complexity. What are the hardwired dimensions of humanity that can give us that sense of possibility that we can make this turn toward life? Well, I see them as four, but sort of coupled. One is innate empathy, which makes it possible for us to cooperate effectively. And the second couple is an innate sense of fairness, then, and coupled with a need for efficacy, for power, which makes it possible for us to actually act on and to establish fairness. So, you know, the scientists are now discovering that, in fact, you know, when they look at our brains as we are cooperating and we're competing with one another, that when we cooperate, that there are parts of our brains that are stimulated and that are the same as when we eat chocolate. That's how pleasant it is to cooperate. And we, of course, understand that we are hardwired to empathize. And I love to think that we're at least as empathetic as the rhesus monkey. And the rhesus monkey, bless their hearts, they will go for up to 12 days in this awful experiment without eating themselves if, in order to eat, to feed themselves, they have to push a lever which will give a shock to another monkey. They will deny themselves food. And so I believe that we are hardwired for cooperation and empathy. And if I can just throw in a grandbaby story, that my new proof is my 2.5-year-old grandbaby. About 5 months, well, 4 months ago, my son, her dad, said, "Has she done this to you?" She comes up to me and she'll say, "Daddy, would you cry?" Or no, "Daddy, are you sad?" He's, "No." "Would you cry?" "Okay." And she cries so that she can comfort him. So she's practicing her empathy. And another version of this, she'll say, "Daddy, cry." And then she runs out of the room. And she comes back and says, "It's okay, I'm here." But what better proof, right? She's enjoying showing her empathy for her dad. Yes, we enjoy cooperation, but we're told that no, we don't. So that what the Science magazine reported a study that was done a few months ago, where they gave a group of people a bunch of money and told them to spend it on themselves, and another group of people a bunch of money and told them to spend it on other people, and then they, at the end of the period, asked, "Well, who's the happiest?" And they concluded that it was. And you, this audience, I'm sure you would guess, it was the people who gave the money away that were happiest at the end of the experiment. But the interesting thing to me is that they were surprised, right? Because we've all been told that, oh, we're of the materialist little selfish little shoppers, right? Of course we'll be happy if we got our new bag or whatever. So, hardwired. Now, I will go so far as to say that we are hardwired for a sense of fairness as well. And that one of the great sources of misery in our society today and overall breakdown is the profound sense of unfairness. And now they've done studies on dogs showing that if dogs are witnessing other dogs getting better rewards, like they had these dogs who were doing these great handshakes with their masters, with no reward at all, until they saw another dog get a biscuit or something. Did you hear about this? And then they went on strike and said, "Forget that. I'm not going to shake your hand for nothing. It's not fair." And they did experiments with capuchin monkeys, where some monkeys were given kind of bland cucumbers, and other monkeys got grapes. And the cucumber monkeys finally said, forget that, and they threw him back at their keepers. So I'm not saying that the capuchins and the dogs prove a lot, but yes, our human experience does prove a lot, that when we feel the rules are not fair, as people are so angry today about what's going on with the over-the-top extreme gap between rich and poor that has so exacerbated in the last 30 years, that ripples out into every aspect of our lives, that sense of unfairness. And equally important, I would argue that when we talk about what we have to work with to make this turn from the spiral of powerlessness to the spiral of empowerment, which I was so glad in your introduction, Frank, it mentioned that the basis of so much of your philosophy is about everyone's being included, their voices heard. To get there is another piece, and that is that we, I believe, are hardwired to need power, efficacy, to know that our actions count. Not just a few of us, but all of us. And that, again, going back to Eric Fromm, he felt this so strongly, observed this so, that he said, we should flip Descartes. It's not, I think, therefore I am. I am because I affect. That we all need to feel effective. So if you think of these cooperation and empathy, fairness and efficacy, that clearly, yes, it is true that we can be the reductive sense of that is the dominant view of human nature. But we also have these very profound pro-social qualities. So I'm saying this is what we can work with. And now that we're here in the beginning of the 21st century, the great thing is that we have so much recorded history that we can look back on and see the evidence of what are the conditions that bring out the worst in us or the best in us. And so we don't have to go on blind faith or blind hope. We can go on evidence. And it seems to me very clear now, whether we're looking at lab experiments on us and what brings out the worst in us, or we look at the history from the Holocaust to Abu Ghraib to Congo or Darfur, we can be pretty certain about what brings out the worst in us. And the first thing that seems most evident to me is the concentration of power. That throughout history, I mean, you think of the prison experiments that were done in 71 when David and I were both in the Bay Area, but this experiment's done in 1971 in the Stanford psychology lab basement where some kids were made into guards, you're familiar with this, and others were made into prisoners. And this Philip Zimbardo, the professor, had designed this experiment to last 2 weeks, and instead he had to stop it in 6 days because these young people who tested normal before the experiment were starting to treat each other, to abuse each other in ways that he now says are eerily similar to Abu Ghraib. So what are the characteristics that bring out the worst in us? This power differential, such as in that experiment, the anonymity because they were all dressed up in their garb, you know, the stereotyping, and the in-group, out-group that happens when people are divided in such a way, and also, I would add, anonymity that can avoid a sense of responsibility. So we know the conditions that bring out the worst in us, and we know something about what brings out the best because we can just flip those conditions and say, okay, what brings out the best in us is the wide dispersion of power, an ongoing dispersion, community in which we know each other face-to-face. There isn't this in-group, out-group scapegoating, and anonymity is diminished. So it seems to me we're at this point where we have a sense of where we are, how we bought this, in a sense, this very flawed premise, this mental map, this very limited sense of self, this premise of lack that has led then to the spiral of powerlessness. And yet we also have enough evidence, both lab experiments and history itself, to say, what else could we be? How else can we be together? And the most exciting thing of my life, and why I consider this the best period of my entire life so far, even though things are much more dire than they've ever been, is that I sense that we are definitely, yes, things are coming down very fast. But just as important, things are moving up into the spiral of power, empowerment. And it's happening on every continent and most places on Earth today. And the more that we can learn about it and be part of it, the more that we can develop that sense of realistic hope that is the essence of our own sense of usefulness. So here is what I'm talking about. That if we really get a grip on both the positive and the negative and not blind to either one, we can then evolve democracy. We are evolving democracy, not from this set system, something that we inherited that's finished and done, that we turn over our fate to some automatic market, but democracy as a set of system values that permeate every aspect of our public lives, whether it's education, whether it's economy, or whether it's politics, every aspect of our lives. The values of fairness, of inclusion, of mutual accountability, not pointing the finger at the evil other, but stepping up and saying, how do I share accountability for solutions? And that is what I call living democracy. Democracy not as something done to us or for us, but that which we are engaged in on a daily basis. It is a way of living. It is a culture of empowerment. And so I just want to give you a few examples. In the dominant spiral of powerlessness, there is basically one economic model. It separates labor and capital. It says that what matters is the GDP. In living democracy, what is emerging? And I want to take you to India, because India, I think, has so many powerful lessons. We think India, and what do we think? Bollywood movies, or we think of the new... I only lasted about the first 15 minutes in that movie. But you think of... at home in Boston, when I listen to the news... I hear the word economic miracle associated with India all the time. And it's talking about all the new high-tech industries and all of this. And yet I learned this is the dominant model. We think of India as, you know, this booming middle class. But wait a minute. Did you know that more people, that as great a share of Indians live on less than $2 a day than the share of people living on less than $2 a day in sub-Saharan Africa? And even before this debacle, this meltdown of our global economy, that the number of people in poverty had increased by 30 million in India over about a five-year period, and that in numbers, in gross numbers, of course, there are more Indians suffering from hunger than there are in sub-Saharan Africa. So what's missed in this picture of the high-tech industry is certainly that, right? The extent of poverty. And what is missed is where the real action is, the living democracy emerging, the living economies emerging. For example, while the Financial Times of India a few years ago said that that the entire high-tech industry in India employs a couple million people, but village-level dairies, they didn't say this, I'm saying that the Financial Times reported on the numbers of people employed in that industry. But what is missed by most people looking from the outside is that in the villages, ordinary Indians creating their own enterprises. In one case, a network of dairy cooperatives involving over 100,000 villagers and has, over 100,000 cooperatives involving 12.3 million, mainly women who started these, and landless women who started these dairy cooperatives that now supply a fifth of the entire milk supply for India, which is a major perhaps the leading dairy producer in the world. So, and this cooperative network is not like a lot of co-ops in the world that create their product but then sell them to a corporation that reaps the primary benefit. No, they do their marketing and reap much more of the benefit. And this model then, because we, another thing we're learning about our power is that as human beings we have neurons in our heads that mirror what we observe. And so as people are watching this, the Bangladeshis are doing a similar kind of cooperative network. So this doesn't fit the dominant model, does it? And it's one of the reasons that very few people know, for example, that the number of people who are members of cooperatives has doubled in the last 30 years, and that now in the world today, there are more people who are members of cooperatives than there are who own shares in publicly traded companies. So just staying in India for a minute, have any of you heard about the epidemic of farmer suicides in India? If you listen to the BBC sometimes, there has been some very important coverage of it. 166,000 farmers in India committing suicide over a 10-year period. I just had the privilege of meeting the rural editor for The Hindu, a major Indian publication. He said he believes that this is the largest concentration of suicides in the history of humanity, that certainly that anyone knows. Well, one of the two states that has the worst experience of farmer suicides is Andhra Pradesh. And what is going on is that companies like Monsanto, based in St. Louis, going in with their genetically modified seeds and promising them that they will benefit so much. And so these farmers are going into debt to buy the seeds and then the pesticides that are required to grow the seeds, but the yields are not producing enough return, and so they can't repay the bank. And in desperation, in despair, they commit suicide by consuming the pesticide. 166,000. And so, here is the living democracy story. Village by village, it started, and I'm gesturing at Frank here because he told me that I had to read this book about how Dee Dee Meyer's book on
Why Women Should Rule the World.
So I'm going to do it. And I'm just remembering, because Frank said this, I'm remembering that when I was learning about what's happening in Andhra Pradesh, that this turnaround began with credit going to rural women. They were saying, okay, we've had enough dying husbands, killing themselves, we've got to do something different. And they started a process of what they call non-pesticide management. Their term is NPM. And over time, over just really less than a decade now, they have converted about 3,000 villages in Andhra Pradesh to non-pesticide villages. And the interesting thing, and it's all been what they call community-supported agricultural management, where it's they're sharing, it's very transparent. I saw a big picture of a village where a big poster in the center of the village where all the villagers could see, okay, how much does it cost to stay on the pesticide route and the GMO, the genetically modified route, and how much does it cost, and then what is your net profit at the end? And then they had the same and comparing it with the non-pesticides. And what happened is that what is happening is the yields don't change that much. There may be a little bit less with the seeds that are not the genetically modified seeds. But the costs are so much less that in this village that's poster show that the farmers came out 18% ahead. And they had not gone into debt, so they didn't have that terrible burden hanging over them. And what was happening is that women and others were creating a whole new industries of what I think of as these little potions to control the pests, so that they were combining cow urine and cow dung and chilies and garlic and various, and neem, which is an ancient tree and sacred tree in India, to create these potions. So they were creating their own little industry instead of the outsiders coming in with the foreign-produced pesticides, they were creating their own and beginning and exchange and selling their organic produce to one another. And so there was a local living economy emerging. And one of the people quoted in one of the pieces I was reading talked about how another benefit was that they were all getting healthier because they were not exposed to the pesticides. So their medical bills were going down, and their animals were not getting sick, so their veterinarian bills were going down. And so I'm just giving you this picture that is what else is going on. And so the next time you hear on the news about the great technological boom, remember that there's something else going on where people are beginning to say, oh, wait a minute, maybe we don't have to turn over our fate to Monsanto. Maybe we don't have to do that. Maybe this isn't working. And they have that moment of dissidence. The dominant model isn't working for them. And they start trusting their own experimentation and their sharing of their information with one another. So that, to me, is part of the what I'm talking about when I describe this. In this case, I mean, hopefully, I mean, this is one of the most tragic in the world, where it had to go this far to this extreme suicides in order for people to wake up and say, no, there must be a better way. But let me take you to another part of the world, which is a little bit more like the U.S. in some ways, very unequal society. By the way, our inequality here now is not very far, the level of inequality, not very different from that of India today. Let me take you to Brazil for another example of what I'm talking about. The fourth largest city in Brazil is Belo Horizonte. Portuguese means beautiful horizon. And in 1993, in Belo, the citizens elected a new city administration that had run on the platform of food as a right of citizenship. And basically, the city officials said, okay, if you are too poor to buy food in the marketplace, you're still a citizen, and therefore, we, the city government, is still accountable to you. But instead of just lengthening the soup lines, or you know, just passing out food stamps as we do, they brought a council of people together, a diverse council, pulled in a diverse council, and set up an agency that dealt with food security. And so you had small businesses and large businesses and farmers and universities and all sorts of religious groups and unions coming together. They came up with literally dozens of ideas of what it could mean to make food a right of citizenship in Belo Horizonte. And what I loved about it is when I learned about it, Anna and I were there, it was all so common sense, and most of it could work just about any place. For example, they teamed up with they offered in any city or most cities would have small plots of municipally owned land that was not being used, you know, just a street corner or a little square in a park or something. And so they said, okay, to the local farmers who's in that time in the 90s their profits were going way down. They said to the local, especially the organic farmers, please come in, use this plot of land. We'll give it to you for virtually nothing. But you have to make food available to the poorest people in the inner city. And so it was a win-win. And when we talked to these farmers, they were totally delighted because they had this huge market they had not had before. And and they also had to take the food out on trucks on the weekends out to the more outlying poor areas. They created they teamed up with larger markets and said to them that they will give them certain benefits if they will keep the prices of about, I think, two dozen basic food items within a, you know, a lower than market price, but they could sell everything else at the market price. And so that then brought a whole lot of people able to purchase healthy food who were never able to purchase it before. They created large open-air restaurants called popular restaurants that were served subsidized meals, but you don't have to prove that you're poor to eat there. So it's not like a soup kitchen here at home where it can feel demeaning to go in there because, you know, all sorts of people came to eat there, but they could get a great meal for 50 cents. And they posted on the bus stops where you can find the best deals for basic foods, because as you know, and here too, that often in the poorest areas, people pay the most for food. So it was very common sense. They started creating school gardens, as certainly California has taken the lead in that regard. But also shifting the frame from food as simply another commodity to food as a right also meant that they began to see things that had been thrown out. They started to see them as resources. So eggshells and manioc leaves that had been tossed out were ground into a flour and put into rolls that were available for school kids throughout all of Belo. So, and this is just a few of the examples of the kinds of things that started happening because people shifted this frame and started talking to each other and thinking, oh yeah, we can do this. We can do this. We don't have to get rid of the market, nor do we have to be a victim of the market. We can put our values around it and make it work for all of us. And so what happened? In 10 years, when I look back at the figures, Belo had cut its infant death rate, which is a very strong sign of hunger. They'd cut it by well over 50%. And I sat down a few weeks ago, and I calculated how much they were spending per person per year. And it comes out, for all this program that has cut the infant death rate by over 50%, it comes out to one penny per person per day. So when I say that solutions are known, I mean, yes, you know, we've got a lot of common sense. None of this required a PhD in economics or it really kind of giving people permission to trust their own common sense. I mean, when you think about it, you know, people think, oh gosh, how are we ever going to end poverty in America? In the 1960s, you know, maligned by the Reagan during the Reagan, the 1960s, the poverty rate in the U.S. was cut in half in one decade in the U.S. And I was born in 44, between 44 and the mid-70s, do you realize that the bottom 20% of Americans, the bottom 20% increased their real income by 116%? And that's on basically one income earner, right? So we know how to do this, you know? We know how to keep wealth circulating. We know about progressive taxation. Hey, what a concept. We know about, you know, encouraging unionization, as we know about a living wage that keeps up, a minimum wage that keeps up with inflation. I mean, I'm just suggesting that it's the frame, is what I'm suggesting. And so I mentioned these few examples to give you a taste of what I think this great turning that we could be in. You know, people ask me, are things getting worse or better since you began your work, Frankie? And I say, both. Both. But will we, you know, it is this moment of choice. Will we stay locked in the premise of lack, not enough goods or goodness? Or will we shift to the premise of possibility, which recognizes both our capacity for good and evil and recognizes what it takes to bring out the best in us and keep the worst of us in check? And certainly, just to repeat, I think this dispersion, ongoing dispersion of power that only a living democracy can bring about is one absolute essential ingredient for life. But when I think about where this talk is taking me, it then takes me to the next level about a very much more personal emotional question of what is required of us to be alive, to stay open, to stay, Stephen mentioned the listening, to be a listener, an observer, truly, and not block it out. Because sometimes I bet you're like I am with the news these days, you really don't want to turn it on. So what can keep us there, open, and engaged in sense of possibility? And one of the things that one of the ways that I answer that for myself is a term that I try to remember, that I'm trying, a quality that I'm trying to cultivate in myself. And I call it bold humility. And I'll mention the bold part first and the humility part second, but they go together. What I mean by the bold part is that I think that when the challenge of our species is that we evolved with certain hardwired understanding of fear. We evolved understanding that to be to have those physical sensations of fear, like when we see the lion, you know, about to attack, and we feel those physical sensations. In my case, it's a pounding heart that goes like this. We should trust those, right? Because we learned that they're very important signals to watch, and we're in the wrong place, wrong time. We better get out of there, fight, flee, or freeze, right? So we learned that these sensations are very important signals of threat. We also learned that the worst thing that can happen to us is expulsion from the tribe. So we learned these lessons about fear at a time, at a very different time in our evolution. But here we are in the early 21st century, where the entire tribe, the hyper tribe as I think of it, is heading over Victoria Falls. So we have to learn some new lessons about fear in such an era. And maybe what we learned back then doesn't serve us today. And we have to think of fear too as in part just an idea that we can rethink. And maybe we're living in an era when separating from the pack is not death anymore, it's life. If the pack is heading over the falls, separating out is a good idea. And maybe these fear sensations, in my case, the pounding heart, most of the time, when I really think about it, it's really telling me, you're right where you should be, and don't you dare run away. And so, if we really understand where we are as a species, then rethinking fear is required. Because I think we're good enough, you know, when we think about these hardwired social qualities we have, I think we're good enough. But I think we need to work on our backbone. And part of that is this rethinking fear. And I have a little cheesy trick that I will share with you. And I say cheesy because I know that's what my daughter would say about it, but she's not here. So, Anna, forget it. Actually, I'll just tell you, I am winding up, by the way. When I was writing this book with my daughter, we agreed on virtually everything, but sometimes she thought I crossed the cheese line. I got a little too cheesy, and so she drew a little cheese slicer in the margin of our manuscript, and I knew I had to kind of pull back. But anyway, so my trick is that when my heart starts to pound, when I'm in an uncomfortable position and I know I should be saying something that somebody doesn't want to hear, I've started reinterpreting that. Instead of "you wimp," I've started reinterpreting that as inner applause. and it works, at least some of the time. So that's the bold humility, and then the humility part. So the humility part is simply that one of the great advantages of getting to 65 is that I can now look back and develop an important new kind of humility that is so freeing. It is so freeing because I realize that all the things that I'm telling you about, like Belo Horizonte, for example, or this dairy cooperative in India, and dozens and dozens of other stories I can tell you about. Like when Anna and I went to Kenya, and we met Wangari Maathai, who started with seven trees on Earth Day in 1977, and now her movement of Greenbelt has planted 40 million trees. All these things that just absolutely stir my heart, I realize I would have given almost no chance of success when I was my kid's age. And that is really humbling. And so it's the kind of humility, though, that if I really take it seriously, then there's only one conclusion I can draw. If I would not have predicted the things that now most get me going and keep me going, then I have to conclude that it's not possible to know what's possible. It's not possible to know what's possible. And that I just keep in personal life, in public life. If we hold to that, then what happens? We're free. We're absolutely free to go for it. And that is where I want to be. And when I say that, I realize that I've got to end with a poem by Denise Levertov that captures, I hope, everything I've tried to say, but much more beautifully and much more briefly. It's called Beginners. Do any of you know this poem by Denise Levertov? We have only begun to love the earth. We have only begun to imagine the fullness of life. How can we tire of hope? So much is in bud. How can desire fail? We have only begun to imagine justice and mercy. We have only begun to envision how it might be to live as sibling with beast and flower, no longer as oppressor. We have only begun to know the power that is ours if we would join our solitudes in a communion of struggle. So much is unfolding that must complete its gesture. So much is in bud. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.